Hi, this is Suzanne. Welcome to the Whispering Gallery podcast. I am so glad you're here. I hope you're doing okay and hanging in there. We'll be leaving the tragedy of Egyptian Brown in the last episode to find a young scientist recording color while at the cusp of discovery, a bilingual Swedish chemist adding a new but dangerous pigment to the game, and we will put a well-intentioned pigment-based hypothesis to bed about the death of Napoleon Bonaparte. Just a few of the unforgettable stories of pigments from our colorful past. You're listening to the Whispering Gallery, so keep your flashlight close in case the lights go out. Possibly 1835, aboard a ship in the East Pacific Ocean, a young scientist wrote, quote, "I had been struck by the beautiful color of the sea when seen through the chinks of a straw hat. Today, 26th, lat 18 degrees, 6s long, 36 degrees, 6w. It was, according to Werner nomenclature, indigo, with a little azure blue. The sky at the time was Berlin with a little ultramarine, and there were some cirro cumuli scattered about." Unquote. This lyrically written description came from the diary of a well-known and controversial scientist, Charles Darwin. He lived in 1809 to 1882. His zoological notebook was dated March 26th, but no year is listed. Could this have been the journey he took as a young man on the Beagle in 1835, when he spent 5 impactful weeks visiting the Galapagos Islands? From my extremely wild guesses on the latitude and longitude from his notes, I think maybe. Solid, right? He mentions Werner's nomenclature. I had no idea what a nomenclature is, so dictionary.com defines nomenclature as a set or system of names or terms as those used in a particular science or art, by an individual or community, etc. Joseph Albers, who was a Bauhaus professor, stated, "If one says red, the name of a color, and there are 50 people listening, it can be expected that there will be 50 reds in their minds. And one can be sure that all these reds will be very different." Interaction of Color, New Haven, Yale University Press, 1971, as shared by Getty.edu. The title of the book is actually Werner's Nomenclature of Colors, Adapted to Zoology, Botany, Chemistry, Mineralogy, Anatomy, and the Arts by Patrick Sim, 2nd edition, printed for William Blackwood, Edinburgh, and T. Caldwell Strand, London, in 1821. And it's a color reference. Werner was a mineralogist. There's a word I can't say. Werner was a mineralogist, and Patrick Sim was a Scottish botanical artist who painted flowers and created natural history drawings. And Patrick Sim, it's S-Y-M-E, so it could be Syme. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing it wrong. I'm going with Sim for now. Patrick Sim was a Scottish botanical artist who painted flowers and created natural history drawings. Patrick was also an art teacher, so the need for a tool like this was pretty much a no-brainer, especially as they weren't going after an interpretation. What they were looking for was accuracy. So, Werner's nomenclature is a color guide to help naturalists, scientists, botanists nail down the colors they are trying to record in nature. So, I bought a copy on Kindle. Hidden inside is kind of a spreadsheet meets color wheel. And that's where I also found that quote from Charles Darwin's writings. Without references like Werner's nomenclature and others like Farbenkugel Color Sphere by Philip Otto Runge, again, another name, R-U-N-G-E, which was later flattened into a color star by Johannes Itten of Bauhaus, would we have the incredible, extensive Pantone reference or the color picker in Photoshop? Maybe even the hexadecimal color codes for the web. CMYK for print. Probably we would have figured this out, but it had to start somewhere. And I would hazard a guess there were probably earlier color references than these that I have never even heard of. Quote, "Spring is the fresh green of young corn and the pink blush of blossoms. Autumn contrasts the yellowed foliage with violet hues. Winter is the white of snow against its black forms. Summer is the contrast of blues and the golden bronze of the corn." Unquote. Van Gogh. Make sure your flashlight is on as we follow the trail of paint, pigment, and colors into their shadowy histories that sometimes turn deadly. Is that your paint tubes I hear rattling with unease? I wouldn't blame them, because there were and are strange things afoot when it comes to pigment in paint for artists. Episode 1 covered the story of Egyptian brown, literally made from Egyptian mummies. Now we're going to tell a few of the colorful tales of pigment's past. Quote, "The kingdom of colors has within it multidimensional possibilities only partly to be reduced to simple order. Each individual color is a universe in itself." Unquote. Johannes Itten. That came from Getty.edu as well, under exhibitions_events. The stories of paint pigment colors are vastly different stories, so let's think about this for a minute. Red pigment, at one time, was sourced from bugs in South America. Yellow. Could the heavy metals in acrylic and watercolor paint, like cadmium yellow, seep into the public water from artists washing their brushes? As recently as 2014, this was under review in the EU. Green. One of the versions of green was used to send insects to the afterlife. And blue was created in the confines of a scorching kiln. These pigment color stories are scattered like seeds on the wind, and I found them when and where I least expected them. Like just watching TV, I came across an expert making Egyptian blue from a recipe recorded by an ancient expert sculptor, Anna Steele. Just watching TV, yeah. Needless to say, I've been on an ancient Egypt kick from the last episode we had on Egyptian brown, and there are some interesting things going on with archaeology from satellite-aided archaeology. I believe they have used LIDAR at some points. Exploring a tomb flooded by the Nile. So, yes, okay, Indiana Jones, right? Let's keep moving. Okay, so caveat here. Caveat emptor, I guess, is the whole thing. I'm not a chemist, so I've been learning about the darker side of pigments from the point of view of an everyday person. So please be careful out there with your paints and supplies, and take your art teacher's lessons about safety seriously. They aren't kidding. I Googled it, and there are material safety data sheets, also known as MSDS, by Winsor Newton, Daniel Smith, and Gamblin, for example. So it's a real thing that this is something to be careful about. To quote Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, danger, danger, danger. Okay, off we go. My accents are known to be terrible. So MSDSauthoring.com says, quote, "A material safety data sheet, MSDS, is a safety document required by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, that contains data about the physical properties of a particular hazardous substance." I learned about MSDS sheets back in the 90s when I was doing administrative work for a petrochemical company in their testing department. Things being shipped to and from the lab required MSDS sheets. The process engineers needed to know what was contained in the test materials. Written in 1538 by Paracelsus, the father of toxicology, quote, "All things are poison, and nothing is without poison. The dosage alone makes it so a thing is not a poison." This can be shortened to, "The dose makes the poison," unquote. Or in Latin, "Sila dosis face da venenum." Thanks to Wikipedia. So what is toxicology? This is how they detect poison and what it does to the body, right down to the basics, cause and effects. The CDC states, quote, "Toxicology is the study of how natural or man-made poisons cause undesirable effects in living organisms, unquote. Now, Britannica.com, we are hopping from expert to expert, defines poison as, quote, poison in biochemistry, a substance natural or synthetic that causes damage to living tissues and has an injurious or fatal effect on the body, whether it is ingested, inhaled, or absorbed, or injected through the skin. When approaching this topic, I needed some solid information, and I found a lecture on Wondrium, Chemistry and Our Universe, How It All Works, by Ron B. Davis, Jr. He talks about poison, toxins, and venom. Poisons cause harm to plants and animals. This can be through inhaling, swallowing, or absorption. Toxins are created by plants and animals as a defense, making them less attractive to others as a food source. And venoms are proteins that get injected. So snake bites, I guess, and bee stings would be too. If anybody has any comments, please feel free to DM me on Instagram or send a message on Messenger. We have a Whispering Gallery Facebook page and a Facebook group, so either place is fine for conversation about any of this. I think the group is the one that is easier to have a conversation in. So do you remember the movie or book, The Princess Bride? There was a battle of wits after they made it up the cliffs of insanity after the sword fight between Inigo Montoya and the Man in Black. Okay, spoiler alert here. If you haven't watched it, it's one of the best. I highly recommend it. So, if you haven't read or watched the movie yet, Vanzini is the head of the group who has kidnapped the princess. The Man in Black is there to rescue her. The Man in Black and Vanzini face off over goblets, and one of the goblets is poisoned. One of them is going to lose. Vanzini sniffs, "I smell nothing." Man in Black, "What you do not smell is called iocane powder. It is odorless, tasteless, dissolves instantly in liquid, and is among the more deadly poisons known to man." Just as an example, that was maybe how a poison would have been used to dispatch an enemy in that fairy tale story. Back to the story about pigments. The pigments in paint can be hazardous, dangerous. This quote from theobserver.com really helps us explain the issue. Toxic art. Is anyone sure what's in a tube of paint? By Daniel Grant in October 19, 2016. Quote, many of the traditional pigments used in paints and pastels are compounds that contain heavy metals, including antimony, barium, cadmium, chromium, cobalt, copper, lead, manganese, strontium, and zinc. Their primary use is in industrial manufacturing, and the mining of them is expensive. Additionally, these metals are linked to various cancers, as well as diseases of the heart, kidneys, liver, lungs, and skin. Concerns about the health risks of the materials they were using grew among artists throughout the 1970s and 80s, and in 1988, Congress passed the Labeling of Hazardous Art Materials Act, an amendment to the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, requiring arts and crafts materials manufacturers to identify product ingredients that are known chronic hazards on the label with appropriate hazard warnings. Manufacturers also must provide safety data sheets for these products that offer detailed information on potential health risks, first aid measures, flammability, how they should be handled and stored, how they should be disposed of, and if they can be safely taken on an airplane. That sounds really good, but I haven't ever received a MSDS sheet. When I've been shopping for paint, I have not received MSDS sheets as part of my purchase. There are no MSDS sheets to be seen as far as I've seen at craft stores or artist stores or online art stores. So I'm not sure who gets to see these, but I'm sure they must be used somewhere, whether it's in shipping to the art store or manufacturing. Just kind of interesting. What exactly is a pigment? If you saw my post about color, I think it's on both Facebook and Instagram, you'll see that pigment is represented, and I think across the board, as a powder, and then it's mixed into things. This definition is from Merriam-Webster.com, the first entry. quote, a substance that imparts black or white or a color to other materials, especially a powdered substance that is mixed with a liquid in which it is relatively insoluble and used especially to impart color to coating materials such as paints or to inks, plastics, and rubber. I know there's a ton of quotes in this episode. We've covered what poison is, check. What pigment is, check. And now we're going to dig into some colors created by pigment. My painting professors told the classes to keep our hands out of the paint and if any got on our skin, to go wash it off with soap. One of my professors, who is actively showing his work around Utah, often painted wearing latex gloves. I wasn't sure if all of the paint was out to get me, or just some. I think a basic chemistry pigment history class would be a great part of curriculum now that I've been digging into it. And maybe it is in places where you go for four-year degrees or a doctorate. But this is what keeps me exploring these strange and new-to-me stories. Not just the paint was dangerous, but the mineral spirits were prone to combust. One of my other professors had been working in his home studio when his dog started getting worked up. As he figured out what his dog was upset about, he ended up in his studio where some of his painting rags had started to smolder, just sitting there. Talk about scary, but good dog. This episode is by no means sharing a comprehensive list of paint or pigment, or even of dangerous colors. This is more just dipping our toes in the water to see what's going on from, say, 20,000 feet. There's a TED Ed's video, History's Deadliest Colors, that maps out white, green, and oranges as the bad colors. Lead white was banned in the 1970s, and orange, uranium oxide, in glazes had radiation, associated cancer risks, like vintage Fiesta ware from this time period, may still be radioactive. Scheele's green, copper arsenite, discovered by a Swedish chemist, Carl Scheele, in 1778, was later repurposed as an insecticide. Chemists, deadly colors, and seriously radioactive dishes? In Disney's animated movie of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs from 1937, the evil queen casts a spell on a perfectly healthy-looking, golden, delicious yellow apple. The apple is dunked in a cauldron of green, bubbling poison. As it rises out of liquid, the poison drips off. She says, quote, look on the skin, the symbol of what lies within, unquote. The queen states this, and as the teal green poison drips, you catch sight of the skull created in the drips of poison. The skull and poison swiftly disappear to reveal what is now a beautiful red apple, ready to take out Snow White for the evil queen. A few years ago, just while we're speaking about Disney, I had an opportunity to see the Disney archives, and they had a multi-plane camera on display that was used to film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Multiple layers of glass mounted beneath a camera, invented in 1933 by Ub Iwerks, a Walt Disney Studios animator-director. And since we're on the subject, I'm going to give you a run-through of what it was from Wikipedia. The multi-plane camera is a motion picture camera that was used in the traditional animation process that moves a number of pieces of artwork past the camera at various speeds and at various distances from one another. This creates a sense of parallax or depth. Various parts of the artwork layers are left transparent to allow other layers to be seen behind them. The movements are calculated and photographed frame by frame, with the result being an illusion of depth by having several layers of artwork moving at different speeds. Unquote. Back to green. Green is the color of zombies. Okay, I know you get it. Green can be beautiful, but it can be spooky too, and in more ways than creating atmosphere. So this is from Wikipedia.org again about Paris green, which was an insecticide. or became one, quote, in 1867, farmers in Illinois and Indiana found that Paris Green was effective against the Colorado potato beetle, an aggressive agricultural pest. Despite concerns regarding the safety of using arsenic compounds on food crops, Paris Green became the preferred method for controlling the beetle. By the 1880s, Paris Green had become the first widespread use of chemical insecticide in the world. It was also used widely in the Americas to control the tobacco budworm. Paris Green was heavily sprayed by an airplane in Italy, Sardinia, and Corsica during 1944, and in Italy in 1945 to control malaria. It was once used to kill rats in Parisian sewers, which is how it acquired its common name. Unquote. I don't know if I enunciated well enough, but this was Paris Green, as in the City of Light. Continuing on, if you wanted to know what it looks like, which I was kind of curious, I looked it up on cdc.gov, the Center for Disease Control, and this is what they said about it. Quote, elemental arsenic is usually a steel-gray, metal-like material without characteristic taste or smell. Arsenic trioxide, an odorless, tasteless, white or transparent, non-flammable solid, is one of the most toxic and prevalent forms of arsenic. The water solubility of arsenic salts varies depending on the salt. And this they've talked about with the Great Salt Lake near where I live. That's actually where we went the other evening during the 4th of July. We took our three dogs and went out to Salt Air, which is by the beach. And the water was way down, and we walked out on the beach, and there was a group of people putting off fireworks, and we didn't stay out super long. The dogs weren't especially huge fans of the salty beach, our little lowrider dachshunds. Boomer was okay, but it was a public place. There had been some glass broken. You know, you want to take your dogs where it's safe for them to walk. So anyway, they say, at least the New York Times recently released an article about arsenic becoming airborne as the Great Salt Lake dries up. And it's not dried up at this point. And here is Willie, so I'm going to take a pause. Those little footsteps. I'll be right back. Let me introduce the studio dogs. Shotzi is a red short-haired dachshund. Willie is a black and tan short-haired senior dachshund. And Boomer is our blonde Shih Tzu Chihuahua, a Shih Tzu. If you hear jingling tags, if they're padding by on small bean toe pads or noshing on a snack, that's who's with me. I've shared photos of them on our Instagram, along with the usual episode art. Look for us under Whispering Gallery Podcast. You can also find us on Facebook. Back to the episode. Back to things here. Van Gogh stated, I tried to express through red and green the terrible passions of humanity. While Matisse said, when I paint green, it doesn't mean grass. When I paint blue, it doesn't mean sky. Early on, verdigris pigment, which was a copper carbonate that was an aqua color, this was made from sheets of copper, hanging over vats of vinegar or wine, which used oxidization that then created a patina that was then scraped off. Mix this all up with oil, and the scraped patina pigment turns green. Left alone, that aqua-colored patina turns brown. So the oil is the key to keeping it the green. The breakthrough of Scheele's green in 1775 was not by a mad scientist, but a pharmaceutical chemist, and at the time, a new member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, Carl Wilhelm Scheele. Just another note, Willie our dachshund, sometimes he gets called Wilhelm or William. So Scheele's green, this was cupric hydrogen arsenite. Again, I am not a chemist, so sorry if I mispronounce things. Still with the copper as copper arsenite and acidic copper arsenite. From remote sensing of ocean and coastal environments 2021, they wrote, arsenite, AS3, is the most toxic form of arsenic and causes acute toxicity. The pigment was originally prepared by making a solution of sodium carbonate at a temperature of around 90 degrees Celsius, 194 Fahrenheit, then slowly adding arsenious oxide while constantly, and that was the dog door, sorry, we have a dog door in my studio, then slowly adding arsenious oxide while constantly stirring until everything had dissolved. This produced a sodium arsenite solution. Added to a copper sulfate solution, it produced a green precipitate of effectively insoluble copper arsenite. After filtration, the product was dried at about 43 degrees Celsius, 109 degrees Fahrenheit. To enhance the color, the salt was subsequently heated to 60 to 70 degrees Celsius and 140 to 158 Fahrenheit. The intensity of the color depends on the copper arsenic ratio, which in turn was affected by the ratio of the starting materials as well as the temperature. Wow. Okay, that was on Wikipedia about Scheele's Green. Far from being legend, inheritance powder, known as arsenic, is poison that has no smell or taste, except in the story to come, when they said there was a scent of mouse. What exactly does a mouse smell like? I don't think I want to know. That's kind of cringy. As in a dead mouse? How did they know what a mouse smelled like back in the day? I had a hamster as a kid, and my hamster kind of smelled like the sawdust in the bottom of his living area. Did they smell like drywall or house? Or did you know that arsenic is created organically by some plants and animals in the ocean? The following came from the University of Maine. So maybe this sheds some light on what's going on with the Great Salt Lake here in Utah. Quote, Earth's crust contains, on average, 2 to 5 ppm arsenic. Though some kinds of materials have much higher concentrations of arsenic. Some examples of arsenic minerals are arsenopyrite, realgar, orpiment, arsenolite, and weathering of these materials will result in some arsenic getting into water and air. That definitely is what's going on with the Great Salt Lake, I guess, or the worries about it. Arsenic is a mining and smelting byproduct of copper, gold, lead, and zinc. And next up, coming in 1814, this was developed on into a deadly emerald green known as Paris green. It was available but tended to blacken. So 47 years later, a doctor put it together that arsenic was toxic. From there, artists turned to cobalt green or zinc green. So how did Napoleon Bonaparte die? One theory was the wallpaper did it. No kidding. When Scheele's Green was introduced, it was used for fabric, toys, and even wallpaper. The idea being that the off-gassing of arsenic was what took him, but that was not the case. So maybe a cautionary tale, I'm not sure if it's more about the green wallpaper or pronouncing yourself emperor, but the story goes that this guy who, after the French Revolution, after Louis and Marie Antoinette, he crowned himself Emperor of France. After some back and forth, exile to an island, escape, and then off to a more remote island in the Atlantic Ocean, far from Africa and Brazil, is where Napoleon Bonaparte died. Some speculated due to Scheele's Green off-gassing arsenic from the wallpaper at the house where he lived, Longwood House. And the following is from historyhit.com by Dan Snow, March 2021. Absolutely remarkable historical sites in St. Helena. Quote, it is famous today as the place selected by the British government to send the French Emperor Napoleon, a man so dangerous that his presence in Europe could destabilize the existing order, enthuse armies of Frenchmen with a revolutionary zeal, and make kings, bishops, dukes, and princes shift nervously on their throne. They found the one place on earth where they could guarantee that they could keep him caged. Unquote. While Napoleon had levels of arsenic present in his hair, this was tested, so did the Empress Josephine and his son Napoleon II. They had similar levels of arsenic. It seems there was not enough arsenic in the green wallpaper to kill him. So, what happened? Well, he was sick, but he wasn't dying from the arsenic in the wallpaper. One theory is that medical treatment mistakes were made. It was discovered after his death that he had a cancerous stomach ulcer. The idea being a combination of things came together causing his death, but it wasn't arsenic. It sounded like a miserable way to go. Quote, "There is no blue without yellow and without orange." Unquote. Vincent van Gogh. You got it. We're on to Egyptian blue. Blue, it's kind of magical, calming, and cool. Brilliant and striking color, and yet as comfortable as old denim and calm as a cloudless sky. Blue is written about beautifully in the book Gathering Blue by Lois Lowry. This is from chapter 9. Quote, "The singer's robe contained only a few tiny spots of ancient blue, faded almost to white. After her supper, after the oil lamps had been lit, Kira examined it carefully. She lay her threads, the ones from her own small collection, and the many others that Annabella had given to her, on the large table, knowing she would have to match the hues, carefully in daylight, before she began the repairs. It was then that she noticed, with relief, because she would not know how to repair it, and with disappointment, because the color of sky would have been such a beautiful addition to the pattern, that there was no real blue anymore. Only a hint that there once had been." This is one of my favorite books. In looking at the description of the book, it doesn't do it justice, but here goes. Quote, "Left orphaned and physically flawed, young Kira faces a frightening, uncertain future. She struggles with ever-broadening responsibilities in her quest for truth, discovering things that will change her life forever." So that's not really enough. So we'll continue just for a second and get back to the color. Quoting from Wikipedia, "She is taught how to further solidify her talent from a much older woman, Annabella, who continues to teach Kira how to create dyes for different shades and hues for her thread work. To Kira's dismay, she learns that there is no ability to create the color blue for the threads that she will be using." And this is from the Giver Quartet of books. The author is Lois Lowry, Lowry. The Giver is also a great book. One last thing, what the book is kind of about and kind of goes beyond the color and storyline is from litcharts.com, quote, "This is exactly what Lowry intends. Blue symbolizes love and compassion. Lowry implies this in various ways. Kira's mother, Katrina, who's one of the few compassionate people in the village, dies of sickness. While she's alive, she sings a song about how blue never lasts." Unquote. So a color representing something our world needs more than ever. You gotta know, I had to come back to Egyptian blue. Egypt and all that, and my Egypt kick, so here we are. I've kind of been on an Egypt kick for quite a while. So here we are, again, blue. The quest for blue was one the ancient Egyptians worked toward and figured out in 2200 BC. It was synthetically produced as a pigment. Zahid Tajieddin, sorry if I said that wrong, who is an archaeologist at University College London, appears in the documentary Valley of the Queens, The New Secrets, which is on Discovery Channel. He discussed the recipe for Egyptian blue that had been carved into a stele, created by a sculptor in 2050 BC as created to be passed on to his first son. It's mostly white sand, ash, limestone, then from Sinai, copper ore, And then Zahid adds water to the minerals and then shapes the mixture into balls, which are a pale green. Then he bakes them at extremely high temperatures, 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit, in a kiln for 10 hours, and they don't burn. Once cool after 20 hours, the balls have turned blue and are crushed into pigment. Here's a quick follow-up on the Mummy Brown episode that we were talking about. In Saqqara, they found millions of animal mummies. They could have been a bird, sometimes an animal, like a cat. Pilgrims who came would purchase a mummified animal from the priest. And some of them being the priests, may have been less than honorable and could have been cutting corners. Empty mummy bundles have been equally valuable, having been created with sacred materials, but caveat emptor, and as Salima Ikram says, don't overjudge a mummy by its cover. It's become clear that when the mummies have been disturbed and the graves desecrated, their chance for immortality has been ruined. There were cats being raised for the purpose of becoming mummies that were messengers to the god. Early form puppy mills with a dismal end. Cats are associated with the goddess Bassett. So here's a weird synchronicity. After I'd released the episode on Mummy Brown, my husband found a book from the same exhibit I visited as a kid in our little free library out by the street. Weird because I don't think any of my neighbors know I host an art podcast or that I was talking about mummies and visiting the exhibit. Some just might say, it's a small world. Others might puzzle over it for a minute. So we could continue going through the pigments and colors, and this would be the episode that never ends. It just goes on and on, my friends. Okay, if you're familiar, I think it's Lamb Chop that sings that song for preschoolers. Anyway, it's the song that doesn't end, that never ends. It's one to avoid unless you want to irritate everybody. Let's take a breath of fresh air. Wow, do we need to be careful out there or what? Poison versus toxin, just be careful out there. The route we're following in this does not necessarily reach into modern colors you may be using. People didn't always care as much about the ingredients in their paint. They wanted the color. But that still, as the MSDS sheets and like heavy metals and different cadmium and different paints, it would be important to continually be careful with your paints. So this is where we leave the colorful story. And with that, a bit of news and thank yous. So news from my studio, Cheery Pie. It's not Cherry Pie, it's Cheery Pie in Virginia has launched their shop. I created their logo for them and you can look them up on Facebook. It was my first time that I've been able to letter something in pie glaze. It was so much fun to work on. They are located across the country from me, so if you're in Virginia, be sure to look them up for some cute, cheerful decor for your home and scented candles. I mean, ice cream flavor candle? Come on. That sounds amazing. Hoping I can order one of those. I don't think they do shipping right now. They're very nice people. The shop is run by Lisa and her husband, Noel. And Noel spends some time during December as Santa Claus. The dogs, okay, so Willie is the newest member of our family. We first fostered him and then adopted him. And he has had a long road back to being healthy. He started out without any fur and malnourished. And now his fur is back and he's at a healthy weight. But this spring he's had a couple of seizures. And that's concerning. He has a good vet and a dermatologist vet and all of these things trying to get him back to health. But some of the medicine they give him makes him a bit of a zombie. So we're going to take him to another doctor for a second opinion that does more alternative vet medicine. Shotzi and Boomer are doing well, and all the dogs had a pool party with their new splash pad a couple days ago. Enough about me now, so let's talk about you. Welcome to all of the listeners from JioSaavn, it's an Indian online streaming service. We're glad you're here and part of our community. Our analytics show that the top three countries of our listeners are listed as India, the United States, and Spain. And I'm coming to you from Utah in the United States. I wanted to give a shout out to Kim, my cousin, who is a music teacher in Idaho, and her art teacher friend. Glad you have joined us too. Apple and GeoSovin are neck and neck, and I don't want to forget our web listeners. Really glad everybody's here for the strange and sometimes unexplainable scary art stories. If you liked this episode, I hope you'll share it or share your favorite episode with a friend. If you could rate and review the Whispering Gallery podcast on the platform you're using to listen to, that will help other people decide if they want to listen as well. Do you have any spooky stories from your studio, art class, gallery, or museum? Or about art that falls into the realm of spooky art, or art history stories, or art hauntings? Send your story or suggestion, or just say hello at whisperingcontact@gmail.com, or you can DM me on Instagram at Whispering Gallery Podcast. I think it would also be fun to talk and have an interview if you have one of these stories. So when you reach out, I'd be happy to set up a Skype call or Google Meet so we can record your story so you can tell it firsthand. Please comment or say hello on Facebook or Instagram. It's always great to hear from you. If you'd like to purchase a Whispering Gallery skull pin, visit the Etsy store. Look for Mystic Mediums Studio. The writing and production of the Whispering Gallery podcast and copyright are held by Suzanne Nicolaisen. Many thanks to the multiple resources that I used to present these stories. I tried to give credit as we went along, from Wondrium to my online resources and books on color, and that worked out pretty well. If you'd like to help, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/SuzNickArt. That's SuzNickArt. And thank you. Thank you so much for your company and for listening as we finished up this story on the colorful tales of pigments past. Thanks for your patience while I have gotten this episode together. I had COVID and that delayed recording and producing this, and it took me a minute to get the episode put together. I hope that you are all able to stay healthy and that you've had your vaccines and boosters. That really seemed to help. And remember, keep your flashlight close and your spooky art stories closer while visiting the Whispering Gallery. Take care. I'll talk to you soon.